and welcome to episode 13 of Science Chat, the science communication podcast. My name is Sean Marshall. In this episode, I look at another of the recent controversies that has happened to science and science communication, the hacked emails from the Climate Research Unit in the University of East Anglia. To discuss this, I spoke to Guardian columnist Fred Pearce, who not only has written extensively on this, but who has constructed a 12-part special investigation into this for The Guardian. Firstly, Fred, let me congratulate you on The Guardian special investigation into the issue of the hacked climate emails from the Climate Research Unit in the University of East Anglia. And to start off, maybe you could briefly set the scene for us. Exactly what is all this fuss about these hacked emails?
There are more than 1,000 emails accumulated at the University of East Anglia's climatic research unit, over 14 years, which somebody, we don't know whether it was an insider or an outsider, somebody hacking in, released the contents of these emails and a number of other data files and other things onto the internet back last November. And since then, a whole series, or in the immediate aftermath, a whole series of allegations were made about what these emails contained, that they showed a sort of conspiracy among climate scientists about confuse or lie to the public about climate change. Climate skeptics as a community leapt on this, and there were a lot of quite vitriolic allegations being made against Phil Jones, the director of Climatic Research Unit, and some of the people that he was emailing, including Mike Mann of Pennsylvania State University, who's the originator of the hockey stick idea, one of the kind of important pieces of research in climate change. So a whole series of allegations that were made, a lot of headlines and so on. And what I tried to do was try and make sense of what had really been going on, what the background to the emails was, what the controversies discussed in the emails were, and whether there was any evidence of a conspiracy or any other kind of wrongdoing.
As you said, Fred, one of the things picked up in these email exchanges related to this hockey stick graph, which showed a net warming effect over the past 1,000 years, with a large increase over the last 200 years.
Yeah.
Was the use of the hockey stick graph by the IPC an intentional cherry-picking of data to show the results that best suited their argument? And isn't there some case to say that a lot of scientists routinely cherry-pick their data when they're actually presenting their research?
No, I don't think there's evidence that anybody was cherry-picking data. It is true that the results you're going to get out of analysing, if you like, sort of proxy evidence of past climate change, tree rings and that kind of thing, is quite dependent on the choices that you make about which data you use, because there are technical issues about which data you use, which tree ring data you use. So there are important choices that have to be made by the scientists. I've no evidence to suggest that they were made in a biased way, but I think it is true that there isn't always the evidence to show that it was unbiased, and that leads to allegations of cherry-picking. But I don't think even certainly the main investigators of this, people like Steve McIntyre in Canada, who was the most prominent of them, wouldn't allege that there was deliberate cherry-picking going on. Scientists have to be careful to avoid that, or their research is of no value. But clearly there are some questions about whether the right protocols were adopted, whether they always documented everything that they were doing. And indeed, the investigation into the science of the Climatic Research Unit set up by the University of East Anglia, which reported 3 or 4 weeks ago, did describe a lack of reporting of working methods and how those choices were made by researchers of the Climatic Research Unit. So that, you know, is troubling, and it doesn't completely undermine the research, but it leads to sort of more concern, and I think that does the line and endorse, in fact, many of the criticisms made by Steve McIntyre and some other of the researchers. So while this is the Oxford report, just so described in the papers, while that didn't accuse the scientists involved of any deliberate misrepresentation or active cherry-picking of data, it did say that there was a lack of documentation on exactly what they had to do, and that obviously is a cause for concern.
But for those skeptics like Steve McIntyre who question Mann's data after it was published, why don't their points of view come out in the peer review process? Are people like these contradictors of a theory, are they not considered to be peers? Are they outside of the peer review process?
They would vary. Some are and some aren't. And they are at certain levels involved in peer review. I mean, Steve McIntyre, for instance, has been a reviewer of IPCC reports or parts of IPCC reports. So he's not completely outside. What the issue is, I guess, that some people like Steve are basically mathematicians. He's not an expert in tree rings. He's a mathematician, a statistician. So there are some questions about whether peer review should involve specialist statisticians in areas where statistics is important. I think you might criticise the scientific journals for sometimes not doing that. So McIntyre has pointed out failings which frankly everybody now accepts in some of the hobby room research in statistical terms, which were not picked up by the original peer reviewers. So I think there's a good case for saying that not necessarily always people with a known political or scientific attitude towards an area of research should be peer reviewers. That's not really the role of peer review. The idea is not to line up, you know, people who are positions against the researchers that you're looking at, but a greater range of expertise. And as part of that expertise, sometimes certainly climate skeptics should be involved. But as I say, most of the main climate skeptics that people know about, Dick Lindzen, Pat Michaels in the US, have both been, Roger Pilkey, I mean, all have been involved in peer reviewing the IPCC assessments, not all involved in peer reviewing individual pieces of research, but certainly involved in IPCC assessments. So I don't think you can say that skeptics are kept out of it. But I think there is a case to say that peer review is not always as good as it's cracked up to be.
Another aspect of peer review that was exposed in these emails is the rejection by Professor Jones of articles that didn't agree with his research. Do you think this is also indicative of peer review, or is this maybe just indicative of the climate change war?
The short answer is I don't know. I mean, I suspect it's not untypical of areas of research, but it may well be, and it begins to look as if climate researchers in that field, and that's not all of climate research, but in the field of analysing past data, were a bit of a closed shop and began to get upset by some of the things being said by their critics and began to have a kind of siege mentality against them. So it did become two tribes, and that's not satisfactory, it's not acceptable, and shouldn't be allowed. And I think as Phil Jones not only is part of that process but also is the director of the Climatic Research Unit, there's some responsibility for that, as do some other colleagues. So I think, yeah, there was evidence of kind of siege mentality of trying to shut down and silence skeptics or their critics in general, and that is not acceptable, and I think that's one of the things that has been exposed by the emails. The emails didn't really show any evidence of a widespread conspiracy to tell lies about climate change, but they did reveal a quite widespread desire to silence critics of, if you like, the mainstream science, and to do it in ways which, in a light of day, don't look terribly good. Now, some scientists will say, yes, well, I know it doesn't look terribly good in the emails, but this is really just the way the scientists work. Well, if that's the case, then I think, that suggests perhaps a wider problem in the scientific community, not just climate scientists.
Another controversial topic that came to light from the hacked emails concerns certain Chinese weather stations used to provide warming data, but of which the location is no longer known for certain. Even if the locations were there when the data was originally compiled, once the evidence has been lost, then the scientists are duty-bound to retract the previous conclusions, aren't they?
Duty is bound to reassess them and to be clear about exactly what they can say and what they can't say, and to make sure that the interpretations are sound. Now, in the case of the Chinese data, which appeared in a 20-year-old report, at a certain level, it raises questions about exactly what we do know about trends in Chinese temperatures. At the big global level, I don't think it changes things much, but it does change things there. And I think Phil Jones has said that he may have to put a correction into his paper to kind of modify his original conclusions, because it's not so as clear as was claimed in the paper about exactly how sure the data being used were, because they weren't so sure about the locations. And that mattered a lot, because the critical to research was whether they were in urban areas and might have been influenced by urban changes and urbanisation going on during the period of the study or not. The original paper said suggested that there were such problems, but it's now not so clear.
A lot of the antagonism between the two parties and the subject of many of the emails relate to the requests by climate skeptics under FOI rules for the data to back up the warming claims. Do you agree that whatever the suspected motives of those seeking access to the data under FOI rules, it's simply wrong to keep the data from them?
In the long term, yes, I do. I think data has to be available. It has to be all open to scrutiny, and that includes the raw data and everything, working methods, the whole lot. There is clearly an issue here about whether the Freedom of Information Act operates in a way that's good for science, or whether it's been applied to science and science data in a way that is right. I think those questions have to be answered. I think probably there was a lack of thinking about the freedom of information and science when the legislation was drafted. But we are where we are. But on your question, I think all data has to be out. Now, scientists might argue, and indeed they do argue, that if they spend a lot of time collecting up research in order to analyse it, collecting up a lot of data, perhaps over a number of years, in order to analyse it, they should be given a reasonable amount of time in order to do their analysis and publish their papers before, other people are allowed to demand the data and do their own analysis. Otherwise, there'd be no incentive, no reason for the researchers to go collect their data at all. It's really complicated stuff like finding trees and analysing tree rings, which is a very labour-intensive and time-consuming activity and requires lots of expertise. If as soon as you've done that, you've collected your data, you don't have any time to analyse it, before somebody else comes along and says, I want all your data, and can go off and do some number crunching and start publishing paper, I think that would be very unfair, and I think most people would agree to that. It's a bit like, if you like, patent law, where, a company should be allowed a reasonable amount of time if it discovers some new thing in order to, say, a drug or something, in order to benefit commercially from that discovery and make some money. Otherwise, they just simply won't do the research in the first place. And I think even for academics, most of the research is mostly not of commercial value, but it is value for their professional careers and so on. They should be allowed to do that. But there all has to be a limit on that, I think. After their initial publications, maybe after sort of 2 or 3 years, something like that, about their data, all their data ought to be made available. And one of the principles of climate science is that science should be replicable. In other words, somebody else should be able to come along and do the research and check the results. Now, for some research, you can just go in a lab and collect up the stuff and repeat the study and see whether you get the same conclusions. But in research where there's lots and lots of data which is very hard to collect, nobody else is going to go back and collect the data again. So anybody who's going to check findings and make sure, replicate the findings, are going to have to use the original data, so they need to have access to the original data. So these are just kind of practical things about what's the best way, a good way to do science, to make sure that it is open, above board, and can be checked, because if it can't be checked and it isn't open and above board, then it doesn't have much value. And I think these issues are all being raised by this. I think scientists have got used to the idea that they can hang on to their data and not give it to anybody else, certainly not anybody outside their immediate community. They share data among, one lab to another, but not sharing it with people outside. And I think they're going to have to rethink some of that, because these days there are more independent amateur researchers out there, more people anxious to look at the data, and ultimately they have to be able to do that. Especially, not only, but especially if the research is being paid for with public money.
On the flip side of that, if you do release your information under the Freedom of Information Act to those that you suspect are going to misuse it, how can you then protect against them during their own cherry-picking, their own selection of data, simply to disprove your theory and to publish their conclusions in maybe a journal that isn't subject to peer review?
Well, you can't, of course, nor should you be able to stop. You can't. You very often can't be certain about people's motives for doing these things. But like in science, like in many other spheres of life, you have to assume that the truth will out in the end. If somebody produces, does some bad research and cherry picks data and then publishes it, then their working methods should be open to review, and people should be allowed to attack them or analyze their work and say whether it's true or not. So no science, no one paper is ever conclusive of anything. Science, as I say, is a clash of ideas, a clash of research until a conclusion is arrived at by repeated work. Now, it's not helpful if people have bad motives, because that, slows everything down and everybody wastes a lot of time trying to discovering whether what they say is true or not. But in the real world, it does happen. And in the real world, people are not necessarily malicious, but just plain mistaken. But you have to have open scientific process. And I think one of the issues here is how open it should be. Exactly how, at what point you say you should be able to publish this, because it's frankly rubbish. And that is part of the sort of that's part of the purpose of peer review. But you can't shut things down too much. If people are legitimately and properly doing research, and are not obviously cherry-picking their data, then they should be allowed to publish that. And if it turns out that they are malicious, you would hope that it would be discovered further down the line. But, these are bad judgments, and that's one of the issues here. So it's when Bill Jones or one of the other people in the email says, I recommended that this paper not be published because I thought it was a bad paper, it is often really not very clear whether it's bad in just in scientific terms or whether it's just too controversial or contradicts what Phil Jones is doing. And I would suggest that if there's a paper that's contradicting what Phil Jones is doing, probably Phil Jones is not the best person to reach to be advising on it, because there's a conflict of interest. But these are difficult areas, because in small groups of researchers in the academic community, people do often have conflicts of interest. As I say, they're not easy issues to solve, but I would suggest that there ought to be presumption on publication generally, because it's better to have these issues out in the open, otherwise they kind of fester. And there's quite a lot of evidence in the emails that long-running disputes over even fairly straightforward scientific matters festered because critics didn't get published.
Looking at the actual hacking event then, in your investigation in The Guardian, you put forward the theory of Charles Rover, the What's Up With That moderator, that the files were simply found sitting on an unprotected FTP server by someone who was looking for freely available data. If this is the case, how significant do you think it is that they found them at that specific time, coming up to Copenhagen, and that when they found them, they were able to distribute them as effectively as they did?
I don't think it proves anything one way or the other. I mean, there were lots of things going on at that time. There was a great deal of activity over freedom of information. My own guess is that probably it had more to do with that, the timing had more to do with that than with the Copenhagen conference. But, you know, until we know who was responsible for putting this material in the public arena, whether it was genuinely a hack or whether it was something slightly different, until we know who it was and can be clear about their motives, we simply don't know. It may have been somebody motivated by wanting to do damage ahead of the Copenhagen climate talks. It might have been somebody anxious to disrupt climate legislation in the US Congress. It might have been somebody angered by the freedom of information requests being turned down at the University of East Anglia, either an external person or indeed an internal person angered by that. Might be somebody else with another motive entirely. I don't think it's very difficult to judge motives at the best of times, and certainly when you don't know who's responsible is. It's all conjecture, we simply don't know. So as I say, I mean, yes, it did come just before the Copenhagen climate talks, though it had very little influence on them, virtually none. So it's dangerous to influence them, and it certainly failed. But there were other things happening at the same time, and as I say, a whole series of freedom of information requests to the University of East Anglia, which were turned down more or less just before the emails to release, might be more significant.
Do you think that we'll ever find out who was responsible?
Well, it doesn't look as if the police are having much progress. I suspect that in the end somebody might own up, might claim it. But there's no sign of anybody doing that now. I would have thought that whoever did it will feel rather proud of what they've done. And would want to one day say, put their hand up and say, it was me. I'm quite almost surprised that they haven't already. That suggests to me that it may be somebody who has something to lose by owning up. And that again would suggest to me that perhaps it's an inside job, somebody with a job which they'd lose if they owned up. But that's conjecture on my part. My own gut feeling is that it might well have an element, at any rate, of an inside job about it. Somebody could easily put something in a play in somewhere on the server where it could be accessed from outside. Could be something like that. But it's all conjecture, we don't know. And as I say, the police don't seem to be making much progress.
Well, finally, if this was just part of the war between the climate scientists and their contradictors, and even if the CRU are fully exonerated by all inquiries, it's possible that the real loser is going to be the public. Who should they believe in now, seeing that both sides seem to be guilty in some respect of using data to prove their own points? And what now for communication of climate data in particular?
Well, I mean, the University of East Anglia hasn't been fully exonerated. If anybody's been criticised, it's been them rather than Phil Jones. So I think probably as a director of the Climatic Research Unit, he can't walk away entirely from responsibility for some of these things. But look, it has not been demonstrated that anybody has engaged in, strictly speaking, scientific wrongdoing, making up data, deliberately lying, and conspiring to not tell us the truth. There is no evidence that anybody has done that, or done that deliberately. They may have shown shut down debates that they shouldn't have shut down, and they may along the way as a result have slowed down scientific progress, but nobody was doing this maliciously or intentionally, or there is no evidence of that. Who should we believe? I think we have to. Let me say. I mean, none of this in any way undermines the idea that carbon dioxide and these other greenhouse gases warm the planet. Now, this is 200-year-old science. Nothing has been discovered or suggested in any of this which undermines that. The fact that these gases, if we keep putting them into the atmosphere, are going to warm the planet. All the research that's been discussed in the emails and is at issue here is about exactly what the historical record temperature is. The hockey stick is about past temperature change. It doesn't say anything at all about future temperature change. Ultimately, because we know there's natural climate change anyway, it doesn't matter a great deal whether exactly how warm it was 1,000 years ago. That doesn't really make any difference to how warm it's likely to be in the next 50 years or 100 years. It's interesting PR if you can say this is the warmest time that temperatures now than there have been for thousands of years. It sounds impressive, but it doesn't actually change the physics of what we know about greenhouse gases and how they're going to warm the atmosphere. So, this is all just about building the historical record of past temperatures, and as I say, it's not fundamental to the science of climate change. So at that level, it doesn't change anything. It really doesn't change anything. But, of course, anything that undermines the work of climate scientists or suggests that they're not quite as squeaky clean as everybody might have liked to think, does have a corrosive effect. But it means that the scientists have got to try much harder to address their critics, to answer questions that the public wants to have answered, and to be very open and honest about their processes, and not to suggest that the things that their conclusions are more certain than they are. So it's a kind of reality check for scientists. They've clearly got to be better at not just communicating, but actually functioning as scientists. As I said, I don't think any of this undermines fundamentally what we're learning about climate change, but it's a real reality check for not just climate scientists, but other scientists about their responsibilities to the public and to openness.
Okay, and on that note, thank you very much, Fred, for talking to me today.
Pleasure.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks again to Fred for providing such a wonderful series of articles about this controversy and for contributing to this episode. Fred's series of Guardian articles are available on www.guardian.co.uk/environment/hacked-climate-science-emails. That's a bit of a complicated web address, but you can find it on my blog, www.sciencechat.net/wordpress, where you can comment on this and other episodes.